Same thing in the Russian. He says, why? Didn't you hear me the first time? Come on.
I know you understand.
He's way too logical. The older one is very patriotic. He roots for Team Russia and everything. He's, he knows the language. He reads books. Uh-huh.
So he's reading Tridiak's autobiography in Russian.
Oh, actually, he's reading it in English. I got the English translation. I couldn't get the original. The original was printed in 1987, uh-huh. and I couldn't track it down. But now he wants it signed now, so I have to go and track Tretiak down and sign it. Shall probably do it in Sochi.
Okay, we're just about ready. Just give me one more
Or?
4 days. Uh-huh. Well, 3 full days. And we came.
Drive?
Yeah, we drove. We like driving together.
Yeah. It's cold, huh? It's cold up there.
The 5-year-old skated on the Olympic Oval, did a couple of laps. I was impressed.
Wow, that's great.
He's going to have to play hockey. He's got no other choice.
I'm ready to go.
We rolling?
Yep.
Okay, well. Thank you so much again, Slava, for doing this. We really appreciate it. If you could just tell us your name and what your current occupation is.
I'm Slava Malamud. I'm a foreign correspondent for Sport Express, Russia's daily national sports newspaper.
And if you can think back to 1980, can you tell us about your memories of the Winter Olympics in that year?
The Miracle on Ice is the first hockey game I remember seeing. I don't remember the 1980 Olympics other than that game at all. I have very hazy memory of the Moscow Olympics, too, in 1980. But the interesting thing, all I remember is that players are coming off the ice, and I asked what happened, and my grandma sitting next to me said, we lost. And I remember thinking, well, that's strange. So I don't remember any games that I saw before it. I must have. I just don't remember them, but I remember feeling that was strange. And I must have had that knowledge in the back of my mind, must have had that not base that that's not right. We should not be losing. Losing is not in the equation. It's out of joint. Something's wrong. And that's... So before even I had any clear memory of what... any clear understanding of what hockey is or what the Olympics are, or what the United States or the Soviet Union are, I knew that our hockey players, we didn't call them Team USSR, we didn't call them the Soviet hockey team, we called them ours, our guys don't lose. We come out, we play, we win, we go home. That was the accepted turn of events. So that was the first clear memory I have of hockey and the first clear emotion I have associated with hockey.
And what? Tell me how your feelings about that event have changed since then, or is anything? What has changed since then? As you've learned more about it.
Well, the thing about the Lake Placid is, Americans tend to think that it was a seminal event in the history of both countries, which probably isn't true. It was a big event in the United States. People who didn't know anything about hockey became interested in the game, and it was. From what I understand, a tough several years leading up to the game in the United States. But for us, it wasn't really such a big thing. Life just went on. Tretiak remained a huge celebrity, the most famous man in the Soviet Union. Growing up, I wanted to be Tretiak. That's all I wanted to be. It was my only ambition in life up until about the age of 11. I had his picture on my wall, and when I looked at it, I didn't think about Lake Placid. The team went on to have very successful careers. It was the base of the team that went on to win the Olympics in Calgary, and before that in Sarajevo, and then in Calgary. And guys like Vladimir Krutov and Vyacheslav Fetisov and Igor Larionov. Larionov was not in that team, but Sergei Makarov. the Kasatanov, these guys went on to have tremendously successful careers, and Lake Placid was looked back at as a, well, a hiccup, an abomination. Things happen. It was a good lesson in humility, maybe. It was a lesson to not get complacent, because that was probably the most important contributing factor, is that the players on that team, we had a couple of two-time Olympic champions, not more than a couple. We had the whole line of Kharlamov line, was two-time Olympic champions. We had Tretiak, a two-time Olympic champion, Vasiliev. We had Zhluktov, who won the Olympics 4 years prior to that. Kharlamov, obviously. We had all these players who were used to strolling in these tournaments, whether they be Olympics or the World Championships, taking care of business, winning, and going on. And that was perhaps for them a bit of a cold shower and a bit of a reminder to not take their opponents lightly. When I talked to Tretiak later on, when I became a journalist, he said that in 1980, right before the games, when they played Madison Square Garden and beat the Americans easily, 10-3, Jimmy Craig, the American goalie, right before the game, was always trying to catch his eye, always trying to get maybe a smile from Tretiak, a nod of recognition. To Jimmy, it was a big thing. And they were looking for that same respect and that same fear and that same worshiping, hero worshiping from the Americans when they met him in Lake Placid when it was the time to play for all the marbles. And when they didn't see it, they didn't know how to respond. When one team refused to be swallowed along with everybody else, they didn't know what to do. And so that was more of a lesson to always keep yourself together and not to look down on anybody. But it was not an earth-shattering event for the Soviet Union. The Big Red Machine went on for more than a decade and continued to dominate in international hockey. And when I read about this event in the book, when I was about 12, I got this book for birthday about the Soviet hockey, the history of Soviet hockey. There were maybe half a paragraph dedicated to Miracle on Ice. One phrase stands in my memory is the Americans jumped well over their heads and played brilliantly and won. And the Soviet Union had to be satisfied with the silver. That was basically it. There was plenty of victories before and after to focus on.
Do you remember any moments from the game itself as a five-year-old?
I remember the puck behind. Now I know it's Mishkin. For some reason, I thought it was Tretiak, but it was Mishkin. I remember the puck in the net and the shot sort of from the back, him standing on his knees and the puck is in the net, and the I believe it was Nikolai Ozerov, the famous Soviet announcer, who was the voice of Russian hockey, saying something like, and Ruzioni scores. And the Russian school of commentating, and the Kharlamov line is on the ice now, and here is a goal. Not a very lucky moment for our team. Face off to come. And he was the most emotional Russian commentator there was.
Do you remember any feelings at that time for you as a kid?
I just remember, well, that's strange. That is not what should be happening. But I wasn't disappointed or distraught or, it's the whole country wasn't really. I don't remember anybody being very upset or anybody swearing or anybody calling for punishments or anything like that. When they came back to Moscow and after the games, and there was this big ceremony at the airport, and the meeting of our Olympic heroes, and obviously everybody was celebrating the skiers and the skaters and what have you, the guys who won the gold, and the hockey players sort of got their things and went away, and nobody paid much attention to them. But that was the extent of the punishment. I know Viktor Tikhonov, the coach, lost it, and there was a lot of finger-pointing behind the scenes. But overall, the feeling in the country was, well, okay, next year there's the World Championship. We're surely going to win that. So the press didn't focus on it. The Soviet press had a way of downplaying things that were not desirable. Obviously, there was no downplaying that. Everybody saw the game. Everybody saw what happened. But, you know, whatever. There was a lot of times when we lose, there's a way to try to explain it away, to maybe blame the other side. And there was a lot of press about Lake Placid, negative press about Lake Placid, not necessarily associated with hockey, but, you know, they lived, the Olympic Village was in a prison. So there was a lot of words said about that in the Russian media. And even now, and I read in Tretiak's autobiography, he talks a lot about it. And it's like, what is it? We come, you say welcome, and it's a jail. Very nefarious. Why you do this to us? And, you know, obviously that was thought of as maybe a little bit of a negative in the games, and the fact that the games were very much commercialized and the Soviets weren't used to it. People were hawking all kinds of junk on the streets, and the prices of the hotels and the restaurants went up 500%, and everybody was, you know, the Japanese didn't do it in Sapporo, the Austrians didn't do it in Innsbruck, why are you doing this now? So that was the negative press. But as for the game itself, it was a hockey game, and the Americans played with fire in their eyes and the desire to win. And everybody acknowledged that and gave them their due. Nowadays, by the way, there are some ways of trying to... I've heard one of the players, I'm not going to name names, one of the players saying that all the Americans were all doped up. Just look at their eyes. Something's wrong with them, for sure. They were insane. But most of the Soviet players recognized the fact that it was just desire to win, that the Americans had something, the hunger, that the Russians didn't. The Russians were too jaded, maybe, and too used to winning easily and didn't have.
If the two teams played 100 times, how many times do you think the Soviet team would win?
Well, Team USA was a good team that year, and Herb Brooks had them prepared very well. The way the Americans were going into this game and the way the Soviets were going into this game, I don't know. It might have been 60-40. The Soviets did not have a good tournament. People forget it, but right before the Miracle on Ice game, they had a terrible game against Canada, and Tretiak allowed 4 goals. They had a terrible game against Finland. Finland was a funny team back then. There was a team that all the big boys were beaten up on, but once in a while, Finland was this weakling, this schoolyard nerd who would once in a while just get mad and give some and push back. So that game against Soviet Union was seen as that type of a game where Finland, usually a weak team, came back and showed some teeth and gave Russians a hard time. It was a 4-2 win, I believe. The Soviets just barely scraped up there. And Tretiak wasn't playing well either. I mean, he had probably the worst tournament of his life. He said later that, you know, he can't remember playing any worse than he was playing in Salt Lake, even before the... So the thing sort of came together. Vladimir Krutov, the only player on the Soviet team who really showed some fire and desire, it was his first big major test. He was trying to get a regular place on the roster. He was playing very well. Sergei Makarov, his line mate, also was playing well, but the rest of the team was just not clicking, and which was the polar opposite of what Herb Brooks did with the American team. They were all ready to die for each other. And if you look at the second goal of that game, when Christian shot it from center ice, and Tretiak made an extremely sloppy save. If Tretiak makes 100 saves like that, I'm sure that's the one time that he allows the rebound to lay there like that. That's not him. He never did that before. And that was the 1 second left on the clock, and the Russian defense stopped and was looking at the clock. And obviously, the guy comes streaming right through them, Johnson, and scores. That should not happen to Team USSR. I mean, we just don't do that. So something was wrong with that team. And You know, people like to say, yeah, I mean, that was the one perfect moment for Americans. I don't think it was a perfect moment. I think it was the result of preparation and the result of wanting it more. And for the Soviets, it wasn't one moment of sloppy goaltending by Tretiak and defense not being aware what time was left in the clock. It was a moment of a series of moments that led up to it that did not have them prepared the way they should have been prepared. And was it the right decision to pull Tretiak? Who knows? I mean, did Tretiak deserve to be pulled? Absolutely. Tretiak deserved to be pulled. He did not play well. Both shots were, by his standards especially, were very savable shots. Was it the right thing to pull him, though, is another question altogether, because Mishkin wasn't prepared to be thrown into that cauldron either. The shots that Mishkin allowed, Tretiak at his best saves. So the team obviously didn't win, so pulling Tretiak didn't work, but it was more than that. So I don't think it's a series of coincidences and a series of planets aligning the right way. I think it's a logical conclusion of a game like this. Now, was it the correct representation of the talent levels or of the strength of those? No, obviously not. It was still an incredible upset that shouldn't have happened, logically. But it was not a freak accident. One team was prepared, one team wanted it, the other team was sloppy and complacent and could not react well. And there's another thing to the equation. The Soviet teams were always good front runners. The Soviet teams were always used to playing ahead of their opponents and keeping that score. They were not very good at trying to chase, trying to respond to adversity, because they never had much adversity. So the Soviet team was just ill-prepared to deal with this situation. And the Americans deserved everything they got.
And you've spoken to some of the Soviet players. Mm-hmm. Are your comments sort of representative of their thoughts? I mean, what was Tretiak's perspective on this?
Tretiak thought that the game was lost by the Soviet team the moment they hit the ice and they saw the faces of the American team. And they saw that these were completely different faces that they saw a few weeks ago in Madison Square Garden. They did not see the fear and the respect, which is something. I mean, they came into this game looking past it. Well, they had a couple of bad games against Finland and Canada. But still, Soviet Union at its worst is better than the American college kids at their best. They beat them 10-3. They were still remembering that 10-3 beating. And they came out and they're thinking, well, who are these guys? These are different players. And at that point, the Soviets could not adjust. And they could not understand what happened. This was wrong.
And did Tretiak have a theory on why that was, or why there was that change in the look of the U.S. players?
Well, looking back, obviously, Tretiak said that Herb Brooks did the absolute right thing in the run-up to the games. He took his team mentally from a place where they were a bunch of scared college kids heading into the biggest moments of their lives and turned them into a bunch of warriors who were out there to defend their country and had to die on the ice, which is something that the Soviets always like to think of themselves as. But in fact, the Soviets in this game were maybe just a bunch of spoiled superstars who were waiting for gold medals to fall in their laps. And the Americans came out. They were mentally prepared. They had a different outlook on that game. And Herb Brooks, perhaps looking back, is now given the most credit for that win from the Russian players, perhaps more so than the American players themselves, because nobody really knows in Russia these names. You know, I was trying to sell to my newspaper the idea of interviewing Mike Ruzioni, and I had to explain to three different editors who Mike Ruzioni is. But everybody knows who Herb Brooks was.
And were there other players that had sort of, I mean, other thoughts from other players about that game that are either support or don't support the things you've been saying?
Slava Fetisov, who was one of the first players who came over to the NHL in the late 80s, and who later would lead the rebellion of the Soviet players against Viktor Tikhonov, the great coach, in order to allow them to go and play in the NHL. He always had this great respect for the North American approach, and he always thought that mentally the North American game is superior to ours, and the way that the players never give up, and the players fight and look at every little battle for the puck as a battle for survival. Whereas the Soviet approach was a little bit more tactical, a little more mind games, try to play wise hockey, try to work as a unit and outsmart the other team and play our game. And Slava always looked back at that game as one of the defining moments that proved that North Americans were more of a fighting outfit than we were. He of course, that was his first Olympics. He went on to win gold medal twice in Calgary and Sarajevo. And so for him, it was a first introduction to this really North American style that he later kind of fell in love with. He's a big proponent of the North American style and to changing the KHL, where he's now one of the big trendsetters in the KHL. He wants the KHL to be more like the NHL, the way it's set up. Smaller ice, the draft, all that kind of stuff. He thinks that the North Americans really have it in the way of organizing and preparing players, and some that maybe we didn't back in the Soviet Union, where it was all governmental and structured and you know, no longer suited for the modern world.
I actually interviewed him on the phone. He talked a lot about the living conditions, and how terrible it was. And He was great. He was an interesting guy. You may have already addressed this, but do you think there was any effect on Soviet or Russian hockey from this game?
Well, if you want to understand how we took this, I remember, what you guys did 8 years prior, 1972, when the first big miracle occurred in the Olympics and the Soviet basketball team beat Team USA in Munich. And there was obviously no end to people saying that was bought and paid for, it was a travesty, we're not going to take our medals, we're going to go and pout for 40 years and counting. But the reality is it was a completely undefeatable team that never, ever played a close game before. Meeting a bunch of determined nobodies who came out and played the game of their lives and outplayed the favorites. I mean, regardless of what happened in the last 3 seconds, they outplayed them. Nobody ever came close to the Americans before in basketball. And that was maybe not an earth-shattering experience for the Americans. They thought of it, sort of treated in their shell and thought of it as a travesty that shouldn't have happened. But the truth of the matter was, yes, they were outplayed. And for us, 1980... maybe it was to a smaller degree because we didn't throw a tantrum on a global proportions. We took our silver medals and went home. But it was a moment of realization that not everything we do turns to gold immediately. Because we had ways of looking at disappointments and turning them into some kind of propagandist coups. Like in 1972, I grew up, I didn't think we lost 1972 series. No, it was a moral victory. We shattered the myth of invincibility of Canadians. We won, right? Nobody talked about the loss. Nobody knew who Paul Henderson was, why he scored the last second goal. That was forgotten. What was remembered is that we won respect. And that even now, I mean, there's a movie just came out about Valery Kharlamov, our great player who played in 72 and 1980. And the movie ends after the first game of the 1972 series. This is where we chose to end that movie. A 7-2 win we won. Of course, I was joking with one of the journalists. I said, why don't we make a movie about Lake Placid and ended after the second period? You know, we won, right? So we had a way of erasing bad things from the press and from the memory. So 1980 didn't really stay with us as an earth-shattering experience, but it stayed with us as a lesson and a gentle reminder that, you know, this is why they play the games. And once Survivor rolled around in 1984 and we just stomped everybody the way we usually do. And don't forget, 1981, the Canada Cup was the only time that the Soviets won the Canada Cup. And we destroyed Canada in the final, 8-1. So there was a lot of things that happened after Lake Placid that took the Russian fans' minds off of it. Kharlamov's death during the Canada Cup. The big win over the team where Wayne Gretzky was playing on, subsequent world championship wins, Sarajevo. So we look back at 1980 as a blind squirrel got a nut, and we got a kick in the nuts. So we got reminded that we should always try to play the way we're meant to play.
So you went to Lake Placid recently. Do you want to just talk about that and any thoughts that brought up for you?
Lake Placid. I went to the museum, the little tiny but very well organized museum. I loved it, despite the fact it was probably the smallest museum I've ever seen. And right there in the corner, behind the pile of Jim Craig's equipment, there's a little TV screen where they showed the game in its entirety. And me and my son stood there behind the American family, maybe five or six people, including kids, watching the game. And they showed the score after the first period, USA 2, USSR 2. And the kid says, USSR, I thought it was Russia. And the dad says, yeah, United States of Soviet Russia, right? Well, maybe it wasn't such an earth-shattering event for America either, but it was interesting to see it. It was interesting to those three or four clear memories I have of that game to sort of superimpose it on the whole setting. And I'm standing right there with the ID tags of every single Soviet player displayed prominently in the museum. My favorite player, Viktor Zhluktov. He was my favorite player because he was the only one in that army team who was allowed to wear a mustache. It was 1980, and he's still going to the 70s style, longish hair, mustache. Looked very 70s. Everybody else was clean-shaven Soviet officers, you know. But Zhluktov, for some reason, I don't know why, was allowed to go all-American on everyone. And I always loved him for it. And there's his picture, you know, looking like a member of the Beatles. And there's Helmut Balderis, a Latvian player who didn't only have a mustache but also had big glasses and looked completely Western. Another one of my favorites. And all of that sort of brought it all back. Tretiak looking like the young communist organizer that he always was. Maltsev's stick on the wall, a very small wooden stick. With which he did magic tricks on the ice. He was one of the most, maybe unheralded, but most magical player in Soviet hockey. He was unheralded because he never played for Red Army. He played for Dynamo. I was a Red Army fan, so to me he was always the respected enemy. It was 1980 was the end of one great Soviet team and the beginning of the other one. The 1970s, of course, the era of Kharlamov and Mikhailov, the absolutely brilliant team. And the 1980s was the era of Krutov and Makarov and Larionov, a team that was just disassembling everything scientifically and mechanically in its way. It's a team that lived together for 11 months out of the year, so nobody had a chance against them. And this is the kind of hockey I grew up with. This is what I dreamed of being. I had a couple of sofa cushions, and I put them against my legs and pretend I was Tretiak. That team sort of symbolized hockey to us. I mean, growing up, the Soviet championship in the 80s was the most boring sporting event you can ever think of. CSKA, the army team, would come out and just would have the gold medals basically awarded to them on day one. There was no competition for them. The national team was what we waited for, as the competitions we wanted to see, whether it was the World Championship or the Olympics or something backwards like the Izvestia Trophy, where Canadians would send a bunch of their amateurs and we would beat them up 7-0 in every game, and everybody was like, yeah, we beat Canada. And my mom would say, oh, was there a fight? Canadians, they fight, you know. So that sort of kind of flooded in when I saw the Olympic Museum and explained to that nice family what USSR stood for.
Did you ever speak to Tikhonov, the coach?
Yes, I spoke to Tikhonov. Unfortunately, the first time I met him was at the lowest point of his life when he was coaching the Soviet team for the last time. The Russian team for the last time. 2004 World Championship in Czech Republic, when Russia wasn't even able to make it out into the playoff stage. The only teams they beat were Denmark and Japan. It was Ovechkin's first World Championship. He became the youngest player ever to play for the Russian or Soviet team. And you could see that Tikhonov being not only the man of the 20th century, but the man of the Soviet era, was completely out of place. He was a man lost in that environment. He had absolutely no respect from the players. One of the players would begin the practice asking, because Tikhonov was always late for the practice. It was walking distance, and Tikhonov walked slowly. And and the player would say, "Has the coach been brought in yet?" So he completely lost that team. He had absolutely no respect from them. So I kind of felt pity for him, and after the last game, just humiliating loss from the Finns, I needed to do a big post-tournament interview with him. So I approach him near the hotel where the team was staying, and I said, "Well, Viktor Vasilievich, good evening. I need to talk to you." And he's looking at my credentials, looking at my name, and says, "Oh, yeah, that's what you look like." And I'm like, oh, my God, this is the moment where I can just die right now, because Tikhonov knows who I am and wanted to see what I look like. Unfortunately, you know, it happened at the time where he was feeling very low, and there was another crew from Czech Republic came in to film him, and he just started screaming at them and wanted to go and start fighting with them. And I had to separate Tikhonov from my Czech colleagues. So that was my first meeting. It's rather it wasn't as grandiose as I thought it would be. It was very businesslike and very strange.
Did you ever talk to him about the 1980 game?
I never talked to him about 1980, no. I've talked to him when I met him. It was the early 2000s, and the Russian hockey was in deep, deep, deep doo-doo, much deeper than we ever were in 1980. And we had other things to talk about, and he was very distraught with the way the Russian hockey was heading. He seemed to me a man trying to make sense of it all at that point. He knew that his hockey days were over, I mean, actively coaching. He didn't know what he would do without hockey. He was a man possessed. Really, if you look at the movie Miracle, which is one of my son's favorite films, despite the fact that he loves Russia, it focused on the American side of the story, and obviously it wanted to show what the Americans went through. And as a byproduct of that, the Russians came through sort of as, like, you know, these faceless opponents, and Tikhonov came across as a kind of a weird type of a man with big eyebrows who's lost in the headlights. Tikhonov was an extremely intense and extremely dedicated man. Hockey was everything to him. Pulling Tretiak was an emotional move. It wasn't like, you're wrong, you let your motherland down, get out. No, it was heat of the moment rage at how Tretiak was not himself. So, I know he took it very hard. I know he took 1980 badly, and I know that there was some finger pointing, and it, I know that he tried to blame some of the players too. Not publicly, but in the behind the scenes and fighting that inevitably ensued. But he recovered from it nicely, and he took basically the same players and ushered in a new era of Soviet hockey in the 1980s. He did it with tremendous cost to the players, because the players had to were torn away from their families forever. They had to spend 11 months out of the year as a unit. And as a result of it, the players rebelled in the 80s when the political climate changed in the country, and you could speak out against your superiors. And that sort of the Soviet hockey came crashing down with the rest of the country after that. But he is the man who ushered in the last great hooray of the Big Red Machine. And he did it because he suffered that humiliation in 1980.
So, you know, to your kids, or not to your kids, to other kids, I mean, what can we take from that 1980 game? What would you tell a kid about that game, that if it matters, why it matters, or does it matter?
It sounds corny, but sports sometimes are corny. And one of the great truths of sports, of competitive sports, is you can never lose the game before it started, and you can never give up, and you can never stop believing in yourself. Ultimately, what broke the Soviets is the fact that Americans were fearless and had no respect for them. No bad kind of respect, adulation. You know. The second period, when we outshot Team USA forever to nothing, the second period should have destroyed them. Going 2-2 into the game, Mishkin barely saw the puck in the second period. He came in for Tretiak. He just stood there. Somebody could have gotten him a book. The game should have been over then. It should have been 6-2 at the end of the second. Pack it in, get ready for the gold medal game, for the last game. We only scored one goal. And that showed the American team that they could do it. They survived that onslaught. If they believe in themselves, if they keep doing what the coach told them, if they look at it as a fight of their lives, that mental preparation and that mental outlook can overcome whatever physical or tactical or speed deficiencies that you have. Whatever other advantages the other team has on you. The Soviets had a great advantage on Americans in the fact that they all knew each other and all played each other with each other. And from a purely hockey standpoint, there was no pluses for Team USA, except the fact that Jimmy Craig was playing the game of his life. But from a mental standpoint, it was all plus for Team USA and all minus for the Soviet Union. The Soviets were just lost in the woods. They believe in yourself, they desire, can, in fact, be a substitute for physical deficiencies and for whatever other head starts that the opponent may have on you.
That's great. Any other questions or things that from that game that you feel like people don't know or maybe should know, just for your being around this game for so long, being around the Russian perspective for so long, you think is worth sharing?
One thing that the movie Miracle sort of touches on is how expressionless the Russians are. If we smile, we get shot. That's not true. The reason the Soviets rarely displayed any outward emotions is because it's a polite thing to do in Russian society. You're not supposed to be outwardly emotional towards strangers. You're not supposed to be like, hey, how are you doing? Nice day today, isn't it? Right? Like the Americans do all the time. We don't do that. No. It's correct and it's polite to be neutral and not to go all wild and loud on people, because that's just considered strange. So our players, the fact that they didn't smile, it wasn't because they were robots. You know, they didn't smile because that's, you know, that's how we are to people we don't know. In fact, after the game was over, Tretiak went into his prison cell in Olympic Village and tried to read a book for 2 hours and just couldn't. He stayed on the same page, and he was just so distraught and so emotionally spent that he went into kind of a stupor, you know. It's not a robot. It's a real human being. And Viktor Krutov, the guy who really had a tremendous tournament, was the best player on the ice for us. He won, solidified his place on the team as a result of 1980. The result of it was that in 1981, when it was time to go to the Canada Cup, Valery Kharlamov, the living legend, was taken off the roster and replaced with Krutov. Now, Kharlamov was getting old, obviously, by Soviet standards. He was a bit hurt, but he was still Kharlamov. You just don't take him off and replace him with a little pudgy kid from Red Army, you know, who, you know, just came along. The result of that was that Kharlamov died in a car accident during the tournament when the team was in Canada. And Krutov forever blamed himself for Kharlamov's death. He came back and he said, well, I killed him. As a result of maybe his performance. You might as well blame Michael Ruzioni for Kharlamov's death, because as a result of Soviet Union's failure in 1980 and Krutov's good performance at Olympics, being a standout on the team that played poorly, he wound up getting another 1981 in the summer of 81, and Kharlamov stayed home and died in a car crash. So Krutov was an emotional wreck after that. He blamed himself for a long time. So, you know, our players may have seemed robotic and may have seemed a little bit like the evil empire stormtroopers that you guys thought they were. But in reality, these were real human beings with real families and real lives and real emotions. And, maybe suppressed a little bit by the fact that Soviet athletes always had to present a good front, but in reality, their stories are just as compelling as those of Jim Craig and Mark Ruzioni and Ruzioni and Herb Brooks.
Thank you, Slava. Anything else?
No, it's okay.
Thank you so much. It's really good.